Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. It's the Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.
Now, here's Mark and Matt.
All right. Well, welcome, everybody, to today's episode
of I'm going to get off my headset here. Let's get real here. So Mark Kohler here. Welcome to today's episode of Refresh Your Wealth. Matt Sorensen will be hopefully joining us a little later. But excited here to have our live broadcast. We do this every 3 weeks. So sometimes it hits twice a month. I think in January it will. And welcome to 2019. Gosh, crazy, right? So we got a lot of live callers. We've got a bunch of email questions, and we're going to try to pull this off here in our little studio, if you will, with internet radio. So it sounds a little scratchy. If you're new to the show, the open form show doesn't have the best sound quality per se because we're live. Yep, no editing on this one. Watch your language if you're calling in and realize this is PG-13 or PG. Sometimes there's a 13 joke in there. But anyway, if you're new again, also, I'm Mark Kohler, your host today. Matt Sorensen, my co-host, is also an attorney. I'm a CPA, Matt's a tax attorney, for lack of a better word, specializing in kind of the retirement plan, self-directed genre. And I'm kind of all about small business and tax savings. And that's what we're talking about today. Building your business, saving taxes, and all the above. So I try to keep it light, try to keep it fun. This is kind of a fun feeling. I used to do the open forum by myself for several years. It was kind of, we call it the Mark Kohler Show. I couldn't come up with anything better. Now it's Refresh Your Wealth, a little nicer. But anyway, so I'm going to do my best here. If there's a question you throw out there on the tax and legal front that I can't field, and again, from all of our small business owners out there, if you're talking tax and legal, I better have a darn good answer for you or something close to it to point you in the right direction. Here in the law firm accounting firm, I'll do, sometimes now that I'm kind of managing the operation more, I'm doing sometimes three to four, usually 2 to 3 consults a day. And when you take out weekends and holidays, that's still 300 work days. And that's 1,000 consults a year. So I'm learning from you guys. You'll hear me say that in the presentation, how much I really benefit from learning from you, the business owner. And so anyway, thanks for being here. So we are going to, on open forum day, if you're a regular listener, you know we're going to bypass the tax tip and the legal tip. We're just going for it. Now, if you're a live caller, if you have, and you're listening through your phone, or maybe even on the computer, if you're dialed in, and we see you there in the queue, you're just listening, driving down the road, that's cool. If you have a question, remember to press the number 1. If you press the number 1, it indicates to me that you have a question. Live callers get priority, and if not, I'm just burning through our email questions and see where things go. So we'll kind of go from there and see how it goes. So, 2019, and I want to highlight this real quick before I get into the first question. This newsletter that many of you hopefully saw yesterday is not just about tax deadlines. There was 3 articles, a 30-minute video, a message all about the strategic planning topic, which is a big one. And Matt and I talked about it on the radio show last week. And some of you may think, hold on, Mark, your tax, your law, what are you doing talking about business planning and the strat planning? Well, I work with so many clients that around the country that we've got to really help just get their business in a better place and make sure they're moving forward. And so I just feel it's such an important topic. And, you know, frankly, if your accountant isn't talking to you about business planning for the year or your business lawyer isn't, I don't think they're doing you justice. They should really be talking about what your goals and aspirations are moving forward. So anyway, so please get to the newsletter and watch that. I'm literally, Matt Sorensen is flying into Idaho. I got him out of Phoenix in January, coming to Idaho, which is the last place you want to go in January. But we are going to go snow skiing. That's the only good reason, right, to get in the snow. So Matt's coming up next week, and we're taking a whole day to plan out our strategic plan for 2019. And I'm going to share with him my personal goals, and he'll usually share with me his personal goals. And that's that board meeting that you really need to have with your family, your loved ones, those that will support you, sometimes not your family, you know what I'm saying? But share it with someone that will help build you up. Okay, well, we're going to dive. Let me take an email question here before we jump on the line, and we'll go from there. So this is from Natalie. And she says, my partner and I took your advice and decided to turn our hobby passion into a business. So we are passionate about music. So we decided to get into the local music scene. Sounds cool. And we love what we're doing for the community, but we need to help figure out either how to start a nonprofit to preserve and support music and art in the North Country in San Diego by providing a community space for artistic expressions through live performances, educational programs, festivals, and da-da-da-da. Where do we start? Okay, so this is great. Natalie, this is an excellent, excellent question. And I think also, Natalie, you're going to get the pleasure of now having even Matt Sorensen on the line with us at this point. So, Matt, you there?
Yeah, I just, you know, strolling into the studios late, you know. Of course, too long of a conversation with the show producer before I got on.
Okay, there you go. Now, you sound a little quiet, so I'm going to say that. I'm going to field Natalie's question. So make sure, Matt, my best friend, that you got your volume up and you're not on headset and all that stuff. You sound a little quiet. Okay, so Natalie says she wants to start a nonprofit. This week, I worked on two nonprofits. Many of you listening, it may be one of your dreams to have a nonprofit. And so a nonprofit is typically called a 501c3. There's all sorts of versions, frankly, but the 501c3 is the most common. And you set up a charity to make the world a better place. So anybody out there considering this, and Natalie, where we start, I'll just tell you how we operate. We send you a memo. We get a questionnaire from you of the vision, the mission statement, your website, your company name, your board of directors that you plan on having, how you're going to raise money, what you're doing. And that's the information we need to get you approved with the IRS and the state to be a nonprofit. You can't go out there and say, hey, I want donations and I want to make music and performance and education in San Diego better, but I'm going to take your money and you get a tax write-off. Well, you have to prove that you're a nonprofit, and that's through a 1023 or a 1024 application with the IRS. And that's after you set up a nonprofit corporation with the state, you get an EIN, you get bylaws, you have your first board meeting. It's quite the process. We charge $3,000. We charge $3,000 start to finish, plus the filing fee with the state and the IRS. And those are going to vary, but we're $3,000 for all the handholding. And sometimes it takes like, gosh, I'm on one. I literally had a client call me this week and say, Mark, can you check on our status? We applied 8 months ago, and we still don't have approval. So it's not a quick process. But you can start operating like a nonprofit and say that your status is pending. But I would say we can get you filed and your application off to the IRS within about a month. And then, because you got to get approved by the state, then we do your application. And then you can start taking donations, start your website. So you don't have to wait for final approval. It's actually retroactive. We'll do a 9-month retroactive approval to a certain date. You get to choose the date. So, Natalie, hopefully that helps. And many of you listening, raise the money. People that donate money for you to do the legal work to start it is a tax deduction for them as well, even though you're not approved yet, because we're going to get a retroactive approval. So, Matt, anything you'd add on starting a nonprofit? I know that you and Catherine have had some visions of doing this, and then you got involved with a nonprofit that was kind of doing what you were doing, so you were able to save some money there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I love where people's heart is in that, you know, about wanting to do something good. But sometimes I think other people get overwhelmed, and by other people I mean me, in trying to do it and start something from scratch. I have so many things I'm trying to do. But So I just found another nonprofit that's actually doing what I wanted to do, and like, hey, I can just jump in and serve here. And so for some people, I think if you have a nonprofit idea, it's always good too to see what other nonprofits are doing. And you may already be familiar with this, but see what others are doing. Maybe it's in a different town or a different part of the country. But there's a lot you can learn from them and how they're approaching it, what they're doing on their website, how they're meeting, what needs they're fulfilling, what community groups they're working with. That can give you a lot of good ideas too, not just, you know, going in and serving and seeing what they're doing, but even just going and otherwise seeing what they're doing without even getting inside in the nonprofit.
Yeah. And Matt, I think your point is great. I'm going to say this last point, then we're going to take a live caller, is anybody out there that's trying to do a nonprofit, someone else is probably doing what you're trying to do already or close to it. Reach out to them. How are you going to differentiate yourself? Or join their ship and say, hey, I want to go in this direction. Will you let me set up a subcommittee and do this? Because, Natalie, I'm sure someone is doing a nonprofit for music and the arts in San Diego, California. There's probably 10 of them. Go find them. Find out what
yeah.
they're doing and go, oh, my gosh, this one we found is doing exactly what we want, but they're not doing it well enough or they need help, and that saves you the headache of doing all this. You can still send me a check for $3,000, but, you know, that might save you time, so.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, Matt, we're going to jump to our first live caller.
Sweet.
Dan from Oregon and Oregon Duck Country. How'd you do in the bowl game, Dan? Did you guys win? I can't remember.
I'm afraid not everybody watches that. Oh, actually, they did. Didn't they? By one point?
I don't even know. I can't even confirm or deny. I don't know.
Yeah. It was a great game then.
I just couldn't keep up with all the bowl games this holiday season. I was just so busy and I wanted to, so it was kind of random. But
and there's so many of them. I mean, there's so many.
Yeah. Well, Dan, I was born in Eugene, Oregon in 1968.
Okay.
And you know, the 60s in Eugene, Oregon, it was similar to Woodstock, I think. So I was probably conceived in the back of a Volkswagen bus somewhere and then dropped off. I was actually adopted. I have no story. I don't know who my real parents are. I know that sounds crazy, people, but I was adopted. And it was Oregon, and I went back there for law school. And so I love hearing that someone's from Oregon. So anyway, enough.
I'm appreciating you went to law school.
What's going on?
Well, I'm getting ready to set up a cash balance plan. And I've talked to a couple different advisors. One says we should invest the money safely for 5% growth because of the tax write-offs you can take for years to come. Another one says, hey, you should invest in more aggressively for faster growth because you want to get to the maximum you can do, and then you can figure out how to take tax write-offs in the future if you want to later on. What are your guys' take on it?
Ooh, I got a quick opinion.
Okay, you go first.
Okay, let me try and state this for everyone else.
Plan is. Yeah, tell everybody what a cash balance plan is first.
So this is basically a pension plan is probably the best way to think about it, or a defined benefit plan. And but they have a little bit of a 401k twist to them. So they're kind of their own little animal. Think of the child of the defined benefit plan and the 401k if they got together, okay? So we have the cash balance plan. But one conflict with the cash balance plan is how much you can put in depends on your age and also how much money's in there. So if you have phenomenal growth, you're not able to sock as much money into it each year anymore because from a pension plan standpoint, they're like, well, you have plenty of money in here. You're going to be fine at retirement, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but to me, that's the problem you want to have. You want to get excellent growth and be confronted with that problem rather than get sold on some like annuity or some other thing where it's like, well, you're just getting guaranteed 5% returns and then you can still contribute your maximum amounts each year. And that I'm more of the opinion of you get the best returns you can, grow it as large as you can. Yes, that could limit how much you put in, but at the end of the day, you got way more money in the account.
Yeah, it also seems like there are
Okay.
other plans you could start dumping into if the cash balance plan wasn't available to you.
Exactly.
Like the health savings plan or something else.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
And there's this thing called the 401H, which is like a sister which is like a supercharged HSA for the wealthy. And for anybody listening, when you have a small business and you start making $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year or more, and you've got your reserve accounts, you're out of debt, and you're really making money, your business has finally hit its rhythm, this is what Dan's talking about is, I want to sock more away than an IRA. I want to sock more away than a 401k. I want to really double down. And that's when this cash balance pension plan stuff starts to come into play. And they're wonderful for small business owners. So this is a great topic for those listening. Now, here's my take, Dan. I'm going to take a different twist. Matt was saying, be aggressive. And Matt knows where I'm going. I'm going to say, with your DB plan, well, for lack of a better term, the defined benefit plan, invest in what you know. That's what matters most, because sometimes the rate of return is attractive and it's safe in one scenario, or it's really aggressive in another. But invest in what you know, and you can self-direct a cash balance plan, which Matt and I are all about. So
I've got his book.
You got the book. But I had these two guys in Heber City, Utah. This is out by Park City. It's beautiful. It's a totally expensive area. It's kind of like the Vail, Colorado of Utah, and this is called Heber City. These guys set up a cash balance plan 10 years ago, and they dumped $200,000 or $300,000 in it right away, got great write-offs, and then they went and bought a development. And anybody who knows Utah knows that Heber Valley and Park City has been on like this 20% a year growth curve off the chart. They developed it, even made more money. 3 years into it, they turned that $200,000 or $300,000 into $2 million. It was insane. The IRS actually wrote them a letter and said, stop, you're going to get penalized if you keep making money in your DB plan. So stop it. Your retirement's already funded. Stop, you know?
Yeah.
And it was just insane. But they knew the market. They knew what they were doing. And they got lucky.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But invest in what you know.
Well, that begs the question back to Matt, because I think it's his bailiwick, is what can you invest it in? Is it exactly like the solo 401k self-directed? Or are there some caveats? How do you avoid UBIT and those kind of things?
Well, the cash balance plan or any DB plan can be self-directed. In fact, 10 or 15 years ago, these are ones we would see a lot, actually, more than you'd see a solo K or a self-directed IRA even. You'd come across a lot of just, you know, business owners. There's a lot of physicians and doctors that were kind of self-directing. And so because they were the trustee of the plan themselves. So presumably you'd be the trustee in this. I don't know if you've
right.
set it up yet if you're a trustee, but
yes,
as trustee, you should have a bank account or a brokerage mm-hmm. account with check writing privileges. So mm-hmm. you could invest it into an LLC, XYZ Investments LLC, that goes and buys real estate. You know, whereas with an IRA,
you've
got a custodian. Yeah, just like an IRA or a solo K, probably the better example. So for my book that has the solo K chapter, it's the most analogous in terms of once you're going to invest in self-direct would be the procedure of solo Ks. It'd be probably the best way to think about it for using a cash balance plan. But you're a trustee, so you can sign off on everything. You kind of got the checkbook control of it typically.
Do you have the same pitfall of UBIT or UBTI?
Yes, you would.
Yes and no. But it's, again, like the solo K. So there's a section on the solo K where you don't have UBIT, UBTI on leveraged real estate, like this UDFI tax, if you're familiar with that. So you get that same exemption that solo Ks get in a DB plan. But otherwise, every other thing of UBIT still applies.
Got it.
Yeah. I was simplifying. When I say
same,
UBIT, however you see UBIT or UDFI treated for 401Ks, it's the same for a cash balance or DB plan. Well, Dan, great question. We're going to move on, but excellent question.
Thank you very much.
Listening. And I'd love the question. And
thanks,
go
man.
Ducks. Good luck.
Thank you.
Did you really just say go Ducks? Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I'm a duck.
You're such a kiss up.
I can say go Ducks.
Oh, okay. You do. Okay. I guess that's some claim there. That's true.
I got some claim.
I will withdraw my prior objection. Withdrawn.
Okay. Okay. Now this is going to be this is a tough one. Once in a while we get a really tough one, and I want to be an equal opportunity podcaster. So I'm going to read it
for hard and easy questions. Okay.
Yeah.
We do not discriminate.
We non discriminate. We just don't choose the softballs. Okay. So this is a mirror in Jordan. So, his I'm going to joke around, Amir, don't be offended. His uncle just said, I inherited $1 billion. I just have to send him 10,000 to claim it. No, I'm just joking. If any of you get that email, it's a scam. Okay. No, but this is really Amir and Jordan. We've got clients all over the country. All over the world. He says, I want to start selling on the USA market and deal with USA suppliers and ship on to USA clients. He's an interior designer himself and have many clients around the world selling furniture from the USA. I want to design, build a website store in Shopify and want to start selling it in the USA with USA suppliers. What is your advice for the company to provide full details on the legal business? Can I open a USA PayPal? Can I sell on Amazon and USA bank account? So let me say I know enough to be dangerous here, Amir, and we do have clients. We don't help clients invest around the world or set up entities around the world, but when we have clients around the world that want to invest in the U.S., we can help them set up their entities, and we do that. So, Amir, generally you're going to set up either an LLC or a C corporation. The reason why is you will not qualify for an S corporation, which would be what we'd normally do for a U.S. resident, but you would get an LLC or a C corp. Now, some of you would say, well, Mark, just do the LLC. Well, guess what? Some countries have a tax treaty where the LLC is not really helpful. In fact, Canadians know that an LLC in the U.S. is not a good deal under NAFTA. So don't just assume the LLC is the, you know, again, the slice of bread for everybody. So, Amir, we would look at what are the treaties between Jordan and the U.S. when it comes to LLCs and C-Corps. You would be either one. You would have this U.S.-based entity. We provide digital mail scanning and forwarding, so you have an inbox that you can look at all your mail. We'd be a U.S. address for you. You get a USA tax ID number. You can get a U.S. Amazon account number and PayPal and a USA bank account. So once you have that U.S.-based entity, you can be a foreign owner of that, and that's okay. Now you're going to have to file a 1040 tax return that you would file in the U.S. as a non-resident. It's called a 1040 NR, and you'd also have to file an entity return for the type of entity you set up, possibly, depending on if it's a single-member LLC. So anyway, that's where you'd start, Amir. I would plan on a couple thousand of legal work to make sure you get the hand-holding, the support you need. There's other company law firms out there that charge you 10 or 20 grand. I don't think you need to spend that much unless you're getting really, really creative and there's some international tax issue. But we can help set up your entity and get you going in the U.S. So for anybody out there listening around the world, and we do have listeners around the world looking to do business in the U.S., that's my answer. Matt, do you have anything you want to add?
Dude, I mean, that was the hard one. I'm just going to let it lie like that. I'm not even going to mess it up by trying to say something.
Okay.
I'm just going to say I concur.
Okay.
I concur.
All right.
I've got an easy one. Can I cover
an easy one? I'm going to find out who our next caller is.
All right, okay, this is an easy one. All right, this is from Stacy. Stacy says, I had an HSA qualified health account for 2018 and now obviously 2019. I opened an HSA account at the end of December 2018. I will fund this account for 2018 in 2019, she says, by April 1st, 2019. In this case, is the 2018 HSA contribution still written off in 2018, or do I need to wait until 2019 taxes? Okay, great question, Stacy. So, for 2018, so long as you had a high deductible health plan in 2018, you can still fund the HSA up until actually April 15th. 2019, it's not April 1st, so you have up until April 15th, 2019, and that will be a deduction on your 2018 return. So don't hurry out and file your 2018 return yet if you haven't put in the money into the HSA. You're going to want to fund the HSA first, get the money in there, and then file the return, obviously, before April 15th, and you'll be able to get the deduction on the HSA for tax year 2018. So, and a lot of times people are funding both years. You know, if you had the high deductible plan in 2018, you still have it in 2019, you can fund your 2018 contribution and your 2019 contribution all in once. And that will obviously include 2018 and then the amount, the other half you'll deduct in 2019. But yes, Stacy, you'll still get the 2018 deduction. You got until April 15th.
I love it. Okay, good answer, man. Okay, we got a live caller, and let's head over there. This is Debbie calling in from Texas. Debbie, welcome to the show. And returning caller, I should say.
Yes. Hi, Mark. Hi, Matt. How are you guys
doing? Hey, Debbie. Excellent. I think we've met at my summit, right? Were you at the Subtractary Summit? Okay.
Mm-hmm. You sure did. Yes, absolutely. Well, it's good to talk to you guys again, and I love following you guys, and your team is awesome. So a big shout out to them.
Thanks.
And I have a couple of questions. Yeah, I have a couple of questions. One is around the wholesaling and in real estate. And another one is a quick one around JVing on a project. But the first one around wholesaling is when I assign a purchase contract or wholesale to a buyer, is it required to register my LLC if it's a contract in another state that I'm assigning other than where it's registered in? Or should I only register my LLC as a foreign LLC if I did a double close, meaning, you know, I take that title down?
Yeah. So. Great question.
I think she's breaking up. Okay, that's too hard of a question. I'm losing her.
Dude, I got this one. I've written a blog article on this.
You got to get an answer for this? Okay.
I got a good one. Yes. I do. Mm-hmm. I do. I was going to dodge that last one on the foreign sales into the U.S. from a foreigner. I don't know. This one I know. So Debbie, here's the way you put the question is great because it's a different answer for each scenario. When you're just wholesaling and assigning the contract, you're not going to take title or close. Don't stress about registering foreign. So if you've got your Texas LLC and you've got a contract and a property in Oklahoma and you're not going to close on it, you're just going to assign it, don't worry about it. Now, the second scenario, if you are going to do the double close, if you've got a contract, you have to close and take title, and then you're going to transfer title to another seller, you should register that Texas LLC, for example, foreign into Oklahoma. And the reason for that is, and I've looked at most states, and I did a blog article on this maybe 3 or 4 years ago, the name of it was, when do I need to register my entity foreign into another state? And basically what most states said is when you conduct business in our state, you have to register foreign. So what does conducting business mean? Now, most of those conducting business would be owning real property for purposes of rent or to rehab or flip or something like that. That would constitute doing business. But just having a contractual interest where you did not yet own the property doesn't seem to fall into doing business where you need to register foreign.
Okay, I like it.
Great.
Okay, and then
thank
there was a follow-up
so
question, Debbie. Is that right?
Yes, please. Yes, so when doing and this is not related to wholesaling, it's just when you're doing a JV, a project, let's say on a new construction, and I have a business partner, how do we handle the 1099s when there are two separate entities on the project?
Okay, I can deal with this one. Matt, may I?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So, Debbie, this is a good one for everybody listening. Whenever you do, I'm going to throw out the word joint venture. So say Debbie calls us up and says, hey, let's do this real estate project together, yada, yada, yada. So unless we form an LLC together, where that's where the 1099 would go if we had an LLC as a partnership. But if we're just going to kind of do this deal together and one partner's going to take the bulk of the money and then 1099 the other one, which is where you can see I'm going with this, in the joint venture agreement, Debbie's going to say, okay, let's sign this contract. I'll close in my company name, and then I'll 1099 you guys for the share of profit. So the escrow company is going to send Debbie the 1099 for the entire closing. She'll have the HUD statement, the settlement statement, and then we're going to do math and look at our JV agreement and go, oh, Matt and I get X. So then she's going to cut us a check for X. She would 1099 us and then get a write-off for that. So that share of the profit she's not taxed on, we are. And that's typically the best way to go in a JV is let one company do it, collect all the money, and then 1099 the other one, right, rather than trying to have a title company split up 1099s, that blows their brain. So.
Okay. Great. Thank you both so much.
Okay.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, great question.
Thanks,
Debbie.
Debbie. Okay.
All right, have a good
one. I like that Debbie Debbie opened the can of worms to 1099s, and I'm going to give a quick side note on this for everybody listening. 1099s are due in January, and I highlight this in my article in the blog this week of how the IRS is coming after business owners with penalties if they don't issue their 1099s. It's crazy. And we charge like $40-$50 set up and $3 a 1099 or something. It's totally cheap to get done, people, but you got to do it. And 1099s are due by the end of January. You have to send them off to all your subs. And if you paid anybody during the year more than $600, you've got to look at the rules. Do I need to send them a 1099 or not? So I'm going to leave it at that. Go read the article. It's in the newsletter. If you don't know where the article is, you can email anybody on our team or just go to markjkohler.com and Google, search for 1099, and there's an updated article in there. But Debbie brings up that term, and we got to make sure we're dealing with it. So
yeah, it's a big one.
All right. Okay. So, Matt, should we take is it Denise? I think it's Denise, not Dennis. Denise in Florida, a question about paying her kids. Do you want to go there?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, I'll read the question, and then you go first. Okay.
Yep.
So she says, I have a corporation, and I presume that's an S-corp. I opened up a family management company to pay my 13-year-old daughter. Because you don't remember, people, you don't want to pay your kids directly out of your corporation. You want to set up a little sole proprietorship. We call it a family management company. Just need clarification for tax prep for 2018. My corporation issues a 1099 to the management company. Cool. That's fine. What tax form do I use to file for the management company? Man, I'm just going to say right here, Schedule C. Schedule C on your 1040. C as in Charlie. Do I include it in my personal taxes since it's a sole proprietorship under my social? Yes. And the management company has zero income. Yes. The 1099 comes into the management company, and then you pay your daughter out, called outside labor, and it zeroes it out. But you still need to file the Schedule C. Do I issue my daughter a 1099 from the management company? No, don't do that, because she does not need a W-2 or a 1099. And if your accountant starts to give you heartache on this, call me and I'll talk to your accountant. Any accountants listening out there, let me ask you, what's the penalty for not issuing a W-2? Oh, it's a percentage of the taxes owed under the W-2. Well, there is no withholding. Oh, but she's a sub. Nope. She's not a sub, so I don't have to issue a 1099 either. Every time I go the rounds with this with an accountant, we get circular and realize we don't have to do a 1099 or W-2. And I never, ever in 20 years had an IRS agent ever look at this and go, oh, where's the W-2 for the kids? So don't worry about it. Now I'll let Matt comment on maybe when you want to W-2 your kids. Because I paid her $3,000. I deposited it directly into her account. She earned every penny. She's such a hard worker. And you guys are great, blah, 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 cheers. Thanks, Denise. So Matt, why would you want to give the daughter a W-2?
Yeah. By the way, I love this question. I love this question that her daughter's, like, working for the money, and she's a hard worker and likes it, and it's so cool. It looks like Denise has a bicycle business, which I'm always down for that, too. So, okay, now, W-2. Maybe you want to issue her a W-2. Do you have to? No. But, Denise, maybe you could teach your daughter about Roth IRAs and throw that $3,000 into a Roth IRA. If she's someone that's good with money, or you think, you know, a 13-year-old that's good with money, maybe let her up a little brokerage account with the Roth IRA, or throw it into a self-directed deal if you self-direct or have other real estate opportunities. It's just a good way to teach kids about money at a whole nother level. My oldest daughter has a Roth IRA, and that's what I pay her. I drop it into her Roth IRA. And so it's a cool thing. But to do that, we would like to see a W-2. You want to issue her a W-2. But don't stress. She's not going to have to file a tax return or, you know, pay tax on that. So, because there will be zeros on the W-2 in terms of withholding and all that stuff. So only consider if you want to do the contribution, though.
Okay. Matt, you ready for a live caller?
All right. Let's do it.
Okay. This is Al. In Boise, Idaho. I'm on the east side of Idaho right now. Al's over in the Boise area. Al, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. So this is probably to Matt, and it's regarding a self-directed IRA. And
all right.
Generally, you cannot, I couldn't fund my own real estate transaction with my self-directed IRA. I could fund somebody else's, though, because of the requirement for it to be arm's length. Is that correct?
Well, when you say fund, I mean the IRA could own its own real estate property, like deal. But when you say fund, I presume you mean like loan money on your own personal
like
real estate deal.
Like a flip.
Okay, but
yeah.
You're going to be the lender on
with
it?
Your IRA.
I'm sorry you guys stepped on each other. Say that again.
Let me ask this. When you say fund a flip or a flip, do you mean own the real estate or be the lender on the real estate? What do you want the IRA to do?
Well, so I guess I hadn't distinguished between those two ways of structuring it. If my IRA is loaning the money on the real estate, that's different from the IRA owning the real estate, isn't it?
Correct, yeah. And that's why I just want to make a distinction, because the IRA, a self-directed IRA, could own real estate, whether it's a rental property or property it owns and you have contractors rehab it and flip it. You know, that the IRA could do that. You don't own that. That's not your deal. It's the IRA's deal. The IRA owns the whole thing 100%.
Right.
And maybe you
and if the IRA,
IRA
owns it, if the IRA owns it, I'm limited on what I can do on the project, right? I have to
correct.
Hire the work done. I can, okay.
Correct.
Yes.
But if
so
I
you,
loan, if the IRA were to loan the money on
yes.
a, actually have a signed mortgage, that would change it, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, but it would loan the money, let's say, to an unrelated person, a friend of yours or another real estate investor, and
okay,
now the IRA is just playing banker.
It couldn't loan the money to me then.
Correct.
Right.
That would
right.
be prohibited.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So that's my I understand that, and I guess where I'm going with this is, so in the situation where you have a couple of people doing business in the same market and they're loaning each other money out of their IRAs, so they have sort of a general agreement to loan money
Ooh.
Into the other person's IRA to do a flip and vice versa. What happens
I don't love that.
With that?
I don't love that
with
one.
The, well, I mean, but if you're is sort of have that agreement back and forth, what happens at such point in time where those two people doing that form a formal business relationship, and then
okay.
it's no longer at arm's length? How does the IRS deal with that?
Well, this is a pretty complex question, but let me say this. My advice is always, because I get this question quite a bit. Hey, I've got money. I've got 100 grand, and let's say this is Matt and Mark. Matt's got 100 grand in his IRA that he wants to use in real estate. Mark's got 100 grand in his IRA he wants to use in real estate. Why doesn't Matt just loan Mark his 100 grand, and then from his IRA, then Mark's IRA will loan Matt 100 grand, right? And,
sure.
and so... But the problem with that is likely prohibited. That is probably a prohibited transaction just on its face.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Because there's an interpretive bulletin on prohibited transaction that says if your IRA does something with someone who's not a disqualified person, unrelated, but then there's a condition that they're going to do something back with you personally, like their IRA is going to loan you money back personally, that results in a prohibited transaction.
Interesting. Okay.
So I would stop there. I don't love that. I'm not. I've ran across it over the years enough, and I usually try and talk people out of that. I think that's going to be prohibited.
Now let me throw out an idea here too, because I like to be an idea guy, and I'm just going to throw this out because Matt talked about loaning to yourself and not good, and then having this quid pro quo where you loan to your buddy and he loans back to you, not good, and then having your IRA own the property outright so you can't work on it is difficult. But here's a fourth option, and that is I tell my clients that are doing development and fix and flip, partner with your IRA. You throw in a little money, your IRA throws in some money, and let the IRA do the flip, but you sub out all the labor. And you can sub out the labor, and you're like, well, Mark, I don't want to pay other subs. Well, you know what? You can give up a little bit of the profit and pay a sub, and you could pay your friend to do the sub work. Now, I don't want that quid pro quo where he does it for free and then you do it for free for him. But if you pay someone out of this LLC owned by the IRA and you, that's okay. You can split the profit. You just can't be the manual labor. Now, in your S-Corp, you're flipping your other properties. You're doing your chip deal, you're just cranking,
yeah.
and that's cool. But anyway, that's just another idea as well.
No, that's good, and that answers the question that if it even looks like it might be not at arm's length, it's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
If it's a
not
yeah,
good.
Yeah. The IRS thought of that stuff.
Yeah.
Trying to get at is if you have an arm's length transaction to start with, and then it stops being an arm's length transaction, that was my question, but I think you've answered that. If it probably was not an arm's length transaction to start with, then.
Right. Yeah. That's where you're. I think you have a problem already at the beginning. So.
Yeah. All right.
Interesting. All right.
Okay. Well.
Thanks for the education.
Yeah. Thanks.
You bet.
Thanks, Al. Thanks so much. Okay. Well, we're gonna keep cranking. Everybody, thanks so much for listening and being involved in this. Man, I'm sweating. Like, I literally am, because I'm always stressed that I'm going to be able to come through on a good answer.
Yeah.
I love the pressure. I love the pressure. Game on. Okay, this is Angie in New York. She asks, hey, Mark and Matt, I have two questions regarding LLCs. Not sure if they're dumb questions or not. Yeah, there's never a dumb question. Angie, if you got this question, there's another listener that's going to love it. If you are a single-member LLC who are having board meetings – in order to keep minutes that you have to do, are there regulations?
She's saying, who are you having board members? She said, who are you having the meeting with is what she's saying. If you're a single member, who's in the meeting?
You're a single member LLC. Okay. Everybody out there. This is good, Angie. I get it now. Thanks, Matt, for clarifying. I'll throw this out. If you've got a single member LLC, that means you're the only owner, but you can have three to five board members that are giving you advice. And we call that a board of advisors. Every LLC we set up now for clients, we ask them, do you have board members, a spouse, children, best friend, sister, brother, grandchild? Put them on your board, have productive meetings, keep notes, and that's it. You don't file them anywhere. They're internal. You put them in your book. It's a tax write-off. You've got the notes to support it in an audit with the IRS. And it makes your LLC stronger from an asset protection standpoint. But that's it. A single member LLC can have a board for sure. They don't have to be owners. They're just on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And then she says, if you form, Matt, I'll give this one to you. If you form a family management company, and the only time we do that is to hire kids, is it a single member LLC with one parent or multi-member LLC with both parents? Does it matter? Or does your S-Corp own it? Matt, will you clarify that?
Yeah, it's just going to – I mean, the family management company, we just do a sole prop. You could do a single-member LLC, but if Angie's in New York, I wouldn't with all the fees and nonsense there. But you just do a sole prop. Just do a sole proprietorship. Do it under one person's social. Usually, because you may use this family management company for other things, like maybe an HRA or something, I would put it in the – If one spouse owns the S Corp, I would put it in the other spouse's social on the sole proprietorship on Schedule C. But it's usually going to be on one person's social as a sole prop on the personal return.
Sure.
Let me come back, though. I want to say one thing on the meetings and the board of advisors thing is
okay.
I think a lot of people like if you already have, Angie, the single member LLC and you don't have a board of advisors or anything, it's just you on everything, you can add that in your minutes. So when you do your next minutes, or if we're doing them as part of company maintenance, just add a little paragraph into the minutes saying, we elect a board of advisors. It's John, you know, Sally and Karen, whatever. And these are my board of advisors to advise the business on, you know, whatever things you want to entrust them with. And it's just an advisory basis. They don't have authority. They're not like an office or anything. And you can just adopt it in your minutes and add it into your company now. Don't stress if you didn't add it in, you know, when you set it up.
Okay. True. Very true. I was just pointing out how much our LLCs kick butt. And
I know. But she's already got one. That's all I'm
LLC,
saying.
Yeah. You want to do it right. You wouldn't do it right. We'll hook you up. Okay.
Yeah.
This is a question from Dan. We already got Dan. I think let me see. And Okay. Yes, we've already covered that question. So Dan called in and he emailed, so I want to make sure we were good there. This is Sinan, a regular caller, says, I moved to Nevada for semi-retirement, and I do not have to pay any state income tax. Yay, that's true. Had a call this week with clients that were moving to a non-state tax state. So that's a tongue twister. There's nine states, people, if you didn't know that, do not pay state tax. Alaska, Florida, Nevada, South Dakota, Texas, Washington, Wyoming, New Hampshire, and Tennessee. If you're in one of those states, you avoid the state tax. He says, I travel to and get my main earned income from California. Oh, my gosh, Sinan. You just killed me.
Oh, that was the kiss of death.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I was primed to talk about you not paying state tax. And listen, everybody, did you hear this? I travel to and get my main earned income from California. And of course, you know what question's coming next.
Right.
So I have to do a California tax return, right? Yes. However, I sold a property located in Nevada. Will the capital gain be taxable in California? No. And he says, I don't think so. I just want to double check. So this is Sinan's right on. He moved to Nevada. His retirement income won't be taxable. Any properties he sells in Nevada won't be taxable. But if he earns his main income in California, he's going to have to pay taxes in California and file. Now, I don't know if that's a W-2 or if it's a small business, and then he's got to register in California, blah, blah, blah. But, Sinan, we love you. Thanks for throwing out the question. Matt, you got one?
Yes. I had a question from Glenn about trademarks. Glenn asked, what's the process and timeline for setting up a trademark? And he starts talking about patent stuff too, but let me say this, Glenn, on a trademark, I think the turnaround time is about 3 to 4 months to get it approved, and that goes to the USPTO, United States Patent and Trademark Office. And basically what the process is this would be like the name of your company, you know, or a product name you may have or service or a marketing slogan, whatever it is that you want to try and protect other people from using in your industry. And so that's that's what the trademark's going to be. Then there's a filing that goes to USPTO, and that's what takes the 3 to 4 months to get approved. There's an examiner that looks at it and is going to look, are there other people that use this or not? Are you the only one? And they do their own inquiry. Are there other trademarks of people that are close to this? And we'll usually search that before we've obviously filed, and we'll advise you on that before we file it. So that's kind of the process. But the first thing to do, I think, would just be get a 30-minute consult. Jerem in our office handles those. He's been doing them for years now, and I've probably done a couple hundred trademarks now. But he can walk you through the process, do a search of what you're thinking to register, and kind of give you a preliminary idea, is this likely to get approved or not, and then make a plan of attack on whether you want to get it filed or not. And we charge $700 plus the PTO, USPTO fee, which is around $250 to $300. So probably about $1,000 total out of pocket that you'll spend to get a trademark. But the power of it is no one else can use it, that name. You know, you've got protection. You can go build a brand or continue to build it if you already have it, have protection of that. So there's a lot of power to having a trademark in your business.
I love it. Okay, we've got a question from David. He says, I have a prospect who wants to buy some education, invest in his business with him, per se. He says, I have a prospect who rolled his 401k into an IRA, which Fidelity now holds. He no longer works at the company where he had the 401k. He has $50K in the new IRA and wants to borrow $20 to enroll in this education. Does he have to self-direct the funds in order to borrow from himself? No. What are his options? Let me throw this out. David, and this is good for everybody listening, and so I'm going to ask you, everybody think, can you borrow from an IRA? What do you think? The answer is no. Can you borrow from a 401k? Yes. Can you self-direct both the 401k and IRA? Yes. So, the last question would be, can I do a 60-day rollover with the IRA? Meaning take the money out of the IRA, use it, as long as I put it back within 60 days, I don't pay any tax. Yes, but you cannot do that in the 401k. So there's all these little differences between the 401k and IRA. So to answer David's question specifically, if this person wants to borrow 20 grand from his IRA, not happening. This client would need to set up a solo 401k under some sort of small business structure, and they could borrow from the 401k. They could have this done within a couple weeks, maybe three at the most. You got a 401k, you got a small business, you borrow 20, you're paying interest back to yourself tax-free. Perfect. But it's not going to happen in an IRA. So David, talk to your client about setting up a solo 401k.
Yeah.
Matt, any questions on your end?
No, sorry, I was just throwing a little plug in there. Let's see here. We had a question. This was from Nilesh. She had a couple questions, but let me hit maybe one or two of these. She asked about, this is another family management company sole prop question. My phone and my email was blowing up the last week of the year. Everyone asking about their family management company and paying their kids and all this. Now I think everybody's getting around to see if they did it right. But she asked about a sole proprietorship. If I'm doing a sole proprietorship, do I need to register with the county or get a DBA, give ads in a newspaper and such and such? No, you don't have to do that. You're just going to be, you know, Baxi sole proprietorship or whatever you want to go by, you know, Baxi family management. That's all you're going to be. You don't need to go register and get a DBA. You don't need a separate tax ID even. You can just use your social. And that's going to be the sole prop that can serve as your family management company. So don't feel like you got to go too complex on this. Remember, the only customer of this family management company is you, your other business, right? And who works for it? Your kids. There's no liability issues. We're not concerned about something suing you. You don't really need to get complex with your banking or tax reporting. Just keep it simple. Sole prop, use your social. You'll need a separate bank account for it. But that's just my advice. Keep it simple. Don't stress about all those DBAs and newspaper ads and all that stuff.
Well, I love it. Okay. This is Roy. He says, I've already used your firm services. I'm spreading the word to all my IT customers as well. Da, da, da. And he talks about referring clients as their how's the best way to do that. And I told Roy here via email, just to schedule 15 or 20 minutes with Matt or I as partners, if you've got a unique way you want to refer us and we can refer clients to you and help build your business, schedule 15 minutes and we'll talk about some sort of collaborative relationship. We can't share legal fees. If you refer people to us, we're going to take care of them. We're going to do a great job, but we can't give you a piece of the action. It's against the law for a law firm to pay a referral fee for a legal service. But we have education packages and all sorts of things. Then he asked, do you have a will and trust creation package like you do for creating entities? We do. And anybody listening, if you haven't got your will and trust done, we've got great pricing and a great paralegal team to just help get your will and trust coordinated with your entity. And a lot of times we'll do a discount if we're doing multiple pieces at the same time. Then a question was, can an HRA, so we'll hit this one in the move, and two healthcare questions. It says, can an HRA, which is a health reimbursement arrangement, it's not an HSA account, it's an HRA, be set up for a C-Corp business, and can the HRA be used to pay out-of-pocket $15,000 of medical expenses on the owner's wife, who also works for the Corp, and kids under age 18, or kids over age 18 if they're dependents? Short answer, yes. You can have an HRA and cover medical expenses for you, your spouse, and your dependents. And it's a wonderful plan. Anybody thinking about getting deductions for out-of-pocket medical this year, get an HRA plan set up in your business as soon as possible. You can read about it. There's a chapter in my book on it, articles, YouTube videos. The video library has longer videos on this. Look into it. If common, I'm making spur some interest. Do a little bit of research on it. We charge $400 for an HRA. Very affordable, and you self-administer it during the year. Then finally says, when my S-Corp pays my health insurance premium and it's listed on my W-2, won't I be paying FICA and other taxes on the health insurance premium? Yes, you are, but we're not going to gross up your W-2 to include health insurance. It's just going to be a portion of the salary you're already taking. So let me tell everybody, if you have an S-Corp out there and your salary is 30 grand this year, and that's what we've determined to be the best salary level for you, and you did health insurance premiums of $12,000, well, we don't take your salary and make it $42,000. We just show your salary at 30, and we show as a box on your W-2 that $12,000 of that, or $12,000 of premiums for your health insurance, were also paid by the company. It's just a protocol that the IRS requires so they know that you had health insurance coverage, or health insurance deduction. So anyway, that's a couple good questions there from Roy on
cool.
healthcare. So.
All right, I got a Roth IRA question from Lance.
Okay.
We got time? Got a little time left?
Yes, sir. We got about 4 minutes or so. Yeah.
Okay. All right, Lance asked about, can I convert my IRA to a Roth IRA and count the income on my 2018 tax returns? Lance, unfortunately, the bad news is no. You can still convert for that traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. However, that will be taxed in 2019. Even though the contribution deadline for 2018 goes until April 15th, the conversion has to be done in the year you want it taxed. So if you wanted to pay tax on it in 2018, you would have had to do it by December 31st, 2018. So sorry to be the bearer of bad news. Maybe 2018 was a loss. And if it was, a lot of times that loss carries forward into 2019, you know, so don't worry, you might get that back. But if you're going to convert now, that's going to go on your 2019 tax return, the amount converted.
Okay. I think we got time for just one last question. Good comment, Matt. This is from A. This caller wanted to stay anonymous because they've got other friends listening to the show, and so they wanted to be cautious. I love it. We can be very confidential.
Yeah.
The question
Peter
was about hiring. Yeah, Peter Lemongello on the call. She said, I had a question about hiring a developer. This might be a website developer, I'm not sure. She says, my husband and his three partners are starting a new service-based tech company. There are a few developers working on the product. Oh, it looks like product development stuff. One of the developers wants his compensation to be 2% equity without voting or profit gain. He'll be working out of his home in the state of New Jersey. Is this doable? Another accountant of my husband's partner consulted said we need to give him compensation as well. I don't know about that. Is that right? No. I didn't think he should be considered as an employee. Besides this, he has a great full-time job, and he'll be working on this project for about 10 hours a week for a few months. Okay. This is great for everybody listening. If someone – you need to hire someone, and they go, well, I don't want you to pay me. I just want 2% of your company. Oof. You got to think, okay, sure, they don't have voting rights, but do I really want to give away 2% of my company? And especially if some of you are doing this in an S-corp, you want to be careful giving away 2% of your S-corp. But maybe if there's an LLC parent and you give away 2%, if you think it's worth it and it saves you cash, maybe. But you don't need to give them a W-2. You don't need to give them a 1099. They're going to be a 2% owner for equity. Now, you would sign a membership transfer agreement. It would nail down everything that they're going to do. You want to make sure they perform, that you don't get ripped off, and then it's hard to get the 2% back. You want to have, like, the pieces thing. So be really careful. Matt, any comment real quick in 30 seconds that you'd add to that?
Yeah, and just think if you're going to sell the company or certain assets of the company, you're going to have this 2% person sign off. So just make sure that you have their agreement in this contract that says, you know, you have full authority to sell and they're going to get whatever proceeds or anything like that. So basically what we're trying to do is make sure they don't, by having just this little 2%, throw a wrench in your big plans.
Yeah. Here's what I would do, and I'm going to say this quickly, is I would do a JV agreement where you say you get 2% of the profit from that product, not the whole company. Say, hey, if you're going to help us develop XYZ product, you get 2% of that, but nothing else. Anyway, thanks everybody for listening. We'll be at Open Forum in 2 more weeks, 2 more shows coming up in between, and we've got great guests lined up. Continue to listen, share the word. We appreciate all of you, and have an awesome 2019, and don't give up on living the American dream. It's real. It's out there. You can get it.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.